CliffCentral.com.
Good morning. It is Friday.
Yes.
And most importantly, it is pretty much the end of July. Yeah, the July is done and dusted, which means August is around the corner, which means, hooray, spring is just a little bit away. That's the good news this morning. And in order to spread this good news, I'm just going to go to Ruth's comment. Love it. She says, yay, the month is done. 1 month more and it's spring. Yes. I don't wish time away, but now I feel about winter. All right, everybody, let's get cracking. We've got a lot to do this morning. We've got Ben joining us in just a short while, and that's always, for some people, the highlight of the week. People like Ben, what can I say? We've also got an incredible guest this morning, someone I've been talking to for a long time, and we've eventually got him on the show, Jack Parrow, who will be joining us live this morning around 7:15. So lots to talk about, lots of good people on the show, and George Meany, of course, a little bit later on with the Auto Trader Pod, and we'll be talking a little bit about the world of motoring, you know, what's going on in our roads, what kind of cars people are driving, what kinds of cool things are going to be happening. It's going to be lots of fun. I'm very excited about that. So lots of people in the comments, we'll get to those just now. I was so happy yesterday, I found, so ridiculous, you know, little things can really make the difference. I found R100 in a book. It's a book, I don't know why, it must have fallen in there or something, because I didn't like hide it away. But I was going through this book, at someone I'm interviewing, and I suddenly, it's like $100 dropped out. And I was like, yeah, this is a good sign. This is a very good sign. So I want to talk about good signs this morning, because whether you believe that there's anything more going on than the material, which you would be stupid not to. And it used to be my position that things that you couldn't explain were inexplicable, so you didn't try to find reasons for them to exist. You didn't try to think about it too much, would have hurt yourself. And because there was no explanation, in the absence of a sensible explanation, human beings always revert to a conspiracy theory of some kind or another. Or they talk about the religious or spiritual realm. And that becomes very dangerous. I totally get why that is not the best way to go. But there's so much that we don't understand. And when I talk about signs, I'm really referring to those little things that happen in your life or in my life or in someone else's life where you think, that is the most bizarre thing. I wonder why that just took place. And you try to figure it out in your head, and then suddenly there are two or three other things that happen that are related to that, and you think, no, this can't be just pure coincidence and chance. There's something, the universe is telling me something. Right? So whether you're into that stuff or you're not, and a lot of people aren't, a lot of people are not particularly bothered by this dog. I've got a puppy who now insists on starting the show with me in the morning. Whether you believe in the universe, synchronicity, some kind of message from above, a spiritual realm, you know, this is the kind of stuff that can really, really make your life interesting. And you don't have to be a true believer. So I would say that these things make a huge difference. And they happen more often if you're connected and you're engaged in the world and you're paying attention, because you see them more often. So, you know, Dr. Hanan would say, well, if I tell you about red cars, you'll see red cars. But I think it really happens. So let me give you an example. This week, out of the blue, a friend of mine, we went to primary school together. We went to nursery school together. He used to give me a lift to varsity for a year because I didn't have a car. And we've always been friends, and we even worked together for a little while. And then suddenly I didn't see him for like 5 or 6 years, not even once. And it was so cool because out of the blue, he called me. On Sunday, and he was like, hey, what's happening? We must definitely get together. Well, I said to him, we must get together when you're back. He's traveling at the moment. And we just kind of picked up where we left off. And it was weird, but it wasn't the weirdest thing. Like, you sometimes do have friends come back into your life. And then I had a meeting with somebody on Wednesday. And this guy brought up this friend of mine's name. And I thought, what a strange thing. Like, in 4 or 5 years, the name hasn't occurred to me. I haven't thought of him. Haven't spoken about him to anybody. And now, in 1 week, it's come up twice. So I think this is quite something. Anyway, then the third thing that happened was another mutual friend of ours sends me a picture of, like, me and him and this friend that I'm talking about and another person who I haven't seen in a long time. And I thought, these are three things. You know, they always say on a graph you need 3 points to be able to plot whether or not something's going up or down. So I looked at this and I thought, this is too weird. Now, it doesn't mean any, it's not like some life-changing thing, but there's got to be something going on when this person's suddenly back in my consciousness. And I don't think that that's entirely by mistake. I think sometimes you actively are thinking about people, and sometimes you don't think about them at all. It's very rare that they should passively enter your world. And this is kind of what happened. So I think this is a, you know, an interesting thing to observe. And it happens sometimes when you're thinking about someone and they phone you, like, out of the blue. That I think that always gives me, like, goosebumps when that happens. And obviously the chances are, you probably, you know, the Dunbar's number is, 120 or something? I can't even remember. I must look it up. But Dunbar's number is the total number of relationships and friendships and actual, like, connections. Let me just see what it is. Dunbar's number. And that is that's the most, 150 individuals. Dunbar's number is the notion that there exists a cognitive limit on human groups of about 150 individuals. So that's the maximum number that you can keep in your world, in your life, connected, meaningful, at any given time. Because we all have like 1,000 connections or 1,000 acquaintances or whatever. And I easily have that. I mean, I've got 4,000 numbers on my phone, which is insane. A lot of these people are business connections. A lot of them are people I've met overseas that I've never seen again. A lot of them are friends that I just haven't, like, made an effort with, or they haven't made an effort with me, or whatever. But 150 is Dunbar's number. So if you've got 150 people in your mind at any given time, it's likely, there's a probability that one of those people is going to call you. So I can scientifically, statistically figure out in my head why that might happen, but it still feels weird when it does, right? So I'd like to hear what you think of this, because it happens to lots of people, and some people attribute enormous value to it. Other people just go, ooh, that feels weird. That's strange. That's coincidental. I mean, Ruth says, when you are open and present, indeed things exist. When you are thinking about someone and then boom, you end up seeing them if the phone rings and it's them. Yeah, it's weird. You know, seeking is better than believing. I agree with that, Vyasin. Where you're interested in the answer, but you're not living your life by the answer. You don't believe. You're not a true believer. But you're interested in answering these questions. That, to me, you don't attribute too much spiritual or religious significance to them. But you know they happen, right? I'm too much of a skeptic, but I do wish I could believe in the spiritual realm, says Chinchilla. Well, that desire to believe will probably take you there. I mean, that's what happens to people. Because they want so badly to believe, they find something to believe in. It happens to me. And then I have to check myself sometimes. The tough part is trying to interpret the sign, like, what do you do after something has come up or occurred three times, says Traveling Ninja Turtle. I don't know. Sometimes it's just, wow, that was weird. And sometimes you make something of it. Sometimes it's a big deal. Corona's Boring says, I met one of those guys in Mshlanga, underground river, tearing a building in two. They're talking about water diviners. You know, those people who, they'll carry a stick. They'll take a stick, which is, they hold two sides and there's a, you know, it's a branch, basically. And the branch will start to do this where there's water. I don't know. If they find water every time, which I'm sure they don't find it every time. But if they do, then people are like, ooh, they've got powers. There's something special going on here. I do think these things are more than coincidence. And sometimes it feels like a glitch in the matrix, right? Sometimes it feels like deja vu happens. You'll be sitting somewhere. You will write something down. You will think of a person. And your phone will ring. All exactly in that order, with you doing exactly the same things, maybe even in the same clothes, on a day where the weather is the same, and you'll think, I've been here before. This feels weird. And when that happens, you're like, oh God, I'm living in a simulation, aren't I? Because it feels that way. Some people are more tuned into these little coincidences, says Tracy. For example, while driving, I saw a crow on a lamppost. 30 seconds later, Counting Crows start playing on my iTunes. You see? I mean, you either one of those people who looks for these things, and then you're always like blown away because you find them. Or you're one of these people who just, they happen to occur, and then you go, wow, that's pretty bizarre. Vyasan says, I know you love history, but you've not discussed Indian history. Seeking rather than believing is why Indian culture has survived for so long. Yeah, I'm roughly aware of where that kind of philosophy comes from. And we've covered a couple of people in Indian history, but it's been more modern Indian history. And the difficulties, like with ancient Egypt, because India is so very old, there's this overlap between mythology and actual history, which is beautiful. I mean, it's the same as the Sumerians. All the very oldest cultures, this is what happens, is it's indistinguishable sometimes which parts are history and which parts are mythology. You know, it's a lot like Christianity, Islam, Judaism. I mean, they still haven't found any evidence of people crossing the Red Sea at any place. And obviously that would be difficult to find because if you cross an ocean, the ocean washes everything away. So it's not like we're going to find, you know, Pharaoh and his army, but we should find something. There should be some evidence. There should be something in the Egyptian chronicles, at very least, about how a vast army was lost at sea. And yet we haven't, because the Moses story, you know, going to Mount Sinai, we should find at least some evidence. It's a desert. There'd be fairly well-preserved stuff, even if it was just tiny little shreds of evidence. And believe me that the University of Jerusalem, for example, has been trying its damnedest to find any material evidence of the Exodus. They've scoured as much of the land around, in, and bordering Israel, wherever they can go, to try and discover some physical material proof of the Exodus. It's hard to do. They've also, you know, Christians have been trying to find proof that Jesus Christ lived that isn't just written proof from the Bible. And it's scant. You can listen to our episode of Blind History on that. It's very difficult to talk about these things. Similarly, with Indian history, there are so many people in the early, early, very misty origins of Indian history who are fascinating, but it's hard to differentiate between reality and mythology and that stuff. And I mean, don't get me wrong, I still love it. It's still fascinating to read. It's still amazing to talk about and think about. But it's hazy. You can't really see how much is actual history, you know, written by objective third parties. Ruth says, Gareth, you need to get Rabbi Goldman on. The name of Moses was ordered to be wiped out of Egypt. Also, they have found chariots in the Red Sea. They have indeed. Sure saw a documentary on it. Yeah, just be careful because you're sure you saw a documentary, but no. I mean, I've watched a whole lot of really interesting kind of alternative history YouTube clips of people who've tried to, you know, say Ahmoses, the Pharaoh, Ahmoses the Fourth, I think it was, who they reckon might have been, you know, the Pharaoh in Moses' story. It's, again, there's a huge amount of not necessarily causal linking that's going on by people who have theories, and it's hard to prove. Anyway, I mean, let's not get into where history and mythology interlink, because to me it doesn't really matter. I mean, if you believe in that stuff, I mean, a lot of people still believe in, you know, in ancient Egypt being a real story. There are people who say, well, you know, there's too much that's been carried. The flood, for example, Noah's flood, has been a central part of almost every human civilization's ancient historical story, from South America to China to Europe to Asia to Africa. They all have this flood narrative in there. And people say, well, if it's part of every culture and some of these have never met each other, then there must be something in our very ancient history that we remember, that we've transferred. But that's asking a lot. It's asking for a big claim. You know, there was this worldwide flood, or at least a flood that was so substantial that it made a mark on human memory that was relayed over maybe 10,000 years, if you believe it. And then, you know, the archaeologists go around and they dig around and they say, well, it could have been when the Black Sea and the Mediterranean finally kind of the sea wall between the two was broken. And there's a possible story in that. There is stuff about kind of the middle of the Mediterranean around some of those Greek islands that have been rocked by earthquakes and volcanoes and massive tectonic and volcanic activity over thousands of years, and that those things could have been the inspiration for the story of the flood. Who knows? You know, you got people actually searching for the ark, the biblical ark that Noah made. Some people say they found it, and then you find out, well, they haven't really. They've just found a boat-shaped indentation on a mountain. And for some people, that's enough. So again, how much of this do you take on as part of your belief? How much of it do you consider to be historical fact? And how high is your standard for fact? Because if your standard for fact is, well, wood wouldn't survive from an ark, so a boat-shaped indentation in a mountain is enough, you know. And yes, it isn't exactly on Mount Ararat, but they might have labeled the wrong mountain. Then your desire for evidence is middling. It's not, you don't have a very high standard for evidence, and that's fine. Then you believe it. And that's also fine. Don't expect other people to swallow that whole, though. Here are a couple of stories. How do you explain this, says Hot Knot. A couple of years ago, I was dressed and ready to go to work when for some odd reason I couldn't find my car keys anywhere. I looked for a good 10 minutes. Keys? Nowhere. I eventually found my keys right in front of me on the kitchen table. On my way to work, a major accident happened. 10 minutes earlier, was I protected by the divine? Well, I mean, we've all got a story that's... I'm not diminishing your story, Hot Knot, but I came down a hill to a T-junction in Pretoria on my way to Varsity one day. Something made me swap lanes. I have no idea why. I went from the right to the left, which is counterintuitive because there were a lot of trucks. Trucks were on the left. Why did I go to the left? This truck came careening down the hill. Obviously didn't have its brakes. Went right past me, smashed the two cars in front of me into a valley in front of them, and the truck went in after them. Now, I don't know. The likelihood of those people surviving is minimal. I never found out because I watched this happen and then almost like a robot just turned and carried on. And then I thought about this for months afterwards. I was like, what made me swap from the right-hand lane to the left-hand lane? Well, that would have been me. I would have been the first car that truck had hit, because I would have stopped right behind the car that it did hit. So, you know, again, what makes you do these things? Sometimes you attribute it to the divine. I don't know. This is all really cool to talk about, but we're never going to get an answer, right? Corona's Boring says, in the Dead Sea, they found two pillars erected by Solomon commemorating the crossing with corallized chariots under the sea. I mean, I think you mean like almost fossilized, but with coral. Yeah, show me that, because trust me, that would be in a museum somewhere for you to see. You'd be able to go and see. It would be physical evidence of the Bible's story being true. It would not just be something on a documentary on History Channel. This would be one of the world's most famous exhibits. It wouldn't just be a story that you really have to search for in the internet. Trust me, it would prove a lot. It would prove, for one, that the Israelites were a people long, long before they'd occupied a part of what is modern-day Palestine, you know, the Levant, that whole area. So there are interests politically today that would love to have that evidence. And yet, they're not claiming too much, which is to their credit, I've got to say. The building and erection of the pyramids is still a mystery. Yeah, that's also true. How they aligned with the stars. This is Graham Hancock, and I've always been fascinated by his interpretation of what the pyramids mean and how they're built and how they're arranged and, you know, what kind of information that might give us about the constellations, particularly Orion's belt about 10,000 odd years ago. He says they line up perfectly. And it appears that he's not making this up. I don't know how to wind the clock back on the heavens, but there are people who have, and they say that he's right. Now, if those pyramids were built 10,000 years ago rather than the 5 or 6,000 years that Egyptology tells us is the window, the time frame, then history stretches much further back than we could have imagined. And if it goes back to 10,000, according to conventional timelines, human beings hadn't even formed basic civilizations of any value, of any noteworthiness by that time. So it's fascinating. I think this stuff really is a study on its own. Corona's Boring says, what about the Vedas? An army of monkey people building a causeway to Sri Lanka. And the fact that under the sea, 5 meters, there is a causeway between India and Sri Lanka. Again, I don't know for sure. When people talk about an army of monkey people, I get a little bit nervous that there's a little bit of embellishment and maybe some hardcore drugs being taken by the people who wrote these stories. Traveling Ninja Turtle says, I'm a firm believer in the power of putting out energy into the universe and attracting a certain outcome. And Sizwa says, quite rightly, speak of the devil and he will appear. Yeah, if you're looking for this stuff, you will find it. So, I don't know. I mean, I'd like to hear more from you. Corona's Boring also continues, in Sinai, the mountain that you're looking for is called the Mountain of Laws. There are calf cow paintings all around the base. Yes, but, you know, again, who did that? What can we date them? It's difficult to figure this stuff out. You can't just find something that you think is related to a story and claim it is. You know, that's why we have historians, archaeologists, people who meticulously gather evidence of whether or not something actually happened. Also, the Egyptians were really good record keepers. If you lost a whole nation of slaves, the Egyptians kept a record of how high the Nile was every year when it flooded. We can still go back and find out exactly how much water the Egyptians had measured the Nile had in it in 3500 BC, for the sake of an argument. You can find that number because they were meticulous record keepers. And they kept their records on papyrus and in stone. So sometimes you can even cross-reference things. You're telling me that they would just leave out, because they were embarrassed, that an entire nation that had worked for them as slaves, and slave labor was big business in those days, that they just escaped across the sea, that there were seven plagues that their God sent in order that had devastated Egypt, they would leave that out of the story? They'd just pretend it didn't happen? Those would be the defining events of any pharaoh's reign, and yet we don't find any Egyptian record of them. So, you tell me. It's a little bit strange. Movies that are based on true stories for a reason. If the spice wasn't added, maybe people wouldn't take notice. That's also true. And then Reynaud is being cynical and sensible about this, which I like. He says it's called confirmation bias, or if someone mentions something that you haven't seen in a long time, then all of a sudden you see it everywhere. Yeah, that's what we've been talking about. There are lots of interesting stories from history that it's difficult to determine whether or not they are, you know, real history or not. And really, the History Channel is a terrible place to learn about history. As people have said in the comments here, it's not the History Channel, it's a conspiracy channel. I mean, how many more documentaries must they make about finding treasure on fucking Oak Island? And they still haven't found anything. They're on season 8 of digging around on Oak Island, which is this nondescript island off of the eastern United States. They've been supposedly looking for treasure there. There was a map. There's a legend. They found some well. Every time I turn that channel on, someone's digging around on Oak Island. And so far, nothing. It's a bullshit story. History Channel is for morons. And it's not history. It's total entertainment. That's all it is. Israel has been mentioned in the Luxor Steel. It's a huge 10-ton block, and the name Israel was carved into the stone. That's the first I've heard of it, Tyrone. But I mean, if you're saying so, I'll look into it after the show. I'd be interested to see what there is. Carl says, "What do you call a kid from Israel? An Israelite?" Oh man, the story of the Ramayan that is significant to Diwali is where they speak of the monkey people. Sure. I mean, again, I'll have to take that with a pinch of salt, because again, Diwali's a religious festival. There's a lot of this that, you know, Lot's wife was turned into a pillar of salt. Do I actually? There are pillars of salt you will see near the south coast of the Dead Sea, where there were supposedly two towns called Sodom and Gomorrah. But they still got to do a lot of work there for my standard to actually say, okay, this is history as opposed to mythology, is high. And it's difficult because sometimes we will never know the answers. Gareth, you should listen to The History of South Africa by Des Latham. Really interesting. That's from Henny. Well, I've got this book, which, just grab this. We're going to be talking to the author of this book, The New History of South Africa, which includes Herman Guillemier, who's probably one of our foremost historians. I don't like the way that history's been politicized in South Africa, and that people are now studying stuff just because it's politically expedient for it to be included in the syllabus. And some stuff has been left out of the syllabus. You know, the old Afrikaans regime, the National Party, used to make us learn interminably about the Great Trek, about Afrikaner nationalism in 1948 and that election and what a great thing it was. I remember learning about it over and over again, to the point where I hated learning anything else about that history. And now I think that the curriculum is so focused on 1994 and post-1994 that we're not paying any attention to what happened before. I mean, in this book, it's divided into 4 chapters. And the first 2 chapters will fit into the last, because obviously it's now political. So we're going to speak to either Bill Nassen or Bernard Mbenga or Herman Guillemier about this book, because it looks like it could be a really interesting book for every parent to have on the shelf for their kids to learn history. And, you know, again, history is fascinating. And the more you know about it, the more you can kind of know about yourself. You can't learn about the future. You can only act on information that you've gathered from history in the present. So you may as well know what happened to you, your people, your country, the continent you live on, the world, where ideas came from. I mean, people who are ignorant of history, you can spot them from a mile away. And they're usually the loudest people who think they know the most, and they embarrass themselves fairly regularly. So I'm glad you brought that up, Henny, but I'll talk to the author of this book. And yes, I'd love to get Des Latham on, speak a little bit about history. I mean, it's a subject that's never going to get boring for me. All right, so let's welcome Ben. Here he is. It is 6:30. Hey, Ben, what's up?
Hey, everybody. Hey, Gareth. How you doing?
Good, man. Nice to see you. What's been happening with you? You've been traveling a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I had some great time in the bush, and nice. I had some work time in Cape Town. You know, just seeing this wonderful country that we call South Africa, Gareth. It's a wonderful place with amazing history. History we should all learn all the time.
You sent the most beautiful picture of a watering hole with a whole bunch of elephants at it. And it was one of those photographs that you took from a fair distance, but it was beautiful. You could see, like, I don't know, 8 elephants in it. Where was that? That's amazing.
I went to Marikele for the first time. So because I bought a car this year, which was to remind me I should be going off-road often.
Right.
It was this maiden voyage into the wilds. And yeah, Marikele is a national park. And you basically drive to Taba Zimbi on really shitty roads.
Yeah.
But then once you get there, it's pretty cool because it's like the start of the Waterberg. So very mountainous, very nice hills. And those elephants, so literally stayed in like one of those sand parks, kind of like deluxe tent things. And there was at one stage 17 elephants right in front of the bright area.
Wow.
And they just pull in for a drink and just play. They were playing for like a couple of hours. And then there were waterbuck, there were dacres, there were monkeys, there was a fish eagle.
Mm.
Yeah. It's just amazing how that stuff does recharge you. You know, people always go on about the fact you need to be in nature and it's so healthy for you.
Yeah.
It really, really, really is. I had 2 ginormously shite work weeks prior to that. And yeah, I felt spectacular afterwards, actually. Really good.
I was at a quiz last night. I usually don't do these things. My sister-in-law invited me, so it was a family thing. It was my brother and sister-in-law and me and 2 of our friends on a team, and then my sister and her boyfriend were on another team with their friends. Of course, it was very important for me that I won, and we did win. So I'll be going again. But my unbroken string of victories remains so.
And did you win a nice prize? Did you win like a branded ice bucket and like a kilogram of biltong?
I thought you know, a kilogram of biltong would have been nice, but I ended up winning a 600 rand voucher at a restaurant. So it's not a bad prize. I mean, I once won a pub quiz in Johannesburg. It kept moving around, and I was on this team with 3 old guys who were in their 60s. But they were serious, like general knowledge people, right? And funny people. They were great fun to be with. And the one was my then girlfriend's father. So, you know, I got along with them well, but it was these 3 old dudes and me. And we did, I think it was like a solid 10 weeks of being at this quiz every week, which is, that's a lot to ask of anybody. You know, it means you really have to be devoted to the cause. But I didn't miss one. We ended up winning. And the prize was big. It was like a diving trip in Mozambique. That was the prize.
Cool.
So I think everything was covered. Plane tickets, accommodation, diving, all the rest of it. But we won it. And I looked around this table. I'm like, I don't want to go to Mozambique with these 3 old dudes. It's not going to be fun at all. In any case, I've seen them for 10 weeks in a row. And as much as they're fun to be around for a quiz, I don't want to be in Mozambique with them. So we all agreed that we would give our first prize to the people who came second. Who'd come second, and we took their second prize, which was a nice big lunch at a fancy restaurant. Yeah.
So you still had to go spend more time with these old geezers either way.
Well, we had a nice lunch and, you know, a boozy lunch, and they ended up drinking a lot.
Yeah, well, when you get old, Gareth, there's not much else to do here. You got to get shit-faced.
Well, that, I mean, listen, when you're that old, I think 2 of them are divorced. One of them is probably not that thrilled about being at home with his wife. So any excuse to get out of the house is a good one.
Yeah, that's true.
What's been happening besides all the traveling?
Not a huge amount here. Yeah, I've just, because I've been like, I had this illness for the first time ever, which was very unsettling. And obviously traveling and doing stuff, I just haven't been training that much, and it's been interesting to go back to a perspective where I was I'm a lot more average than where I was.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in Cape Town, I actually went to a normal gym. It was one of the most horrifying things I've seen in quite some time. Now, I know that sounds hugely condescending, and I'll elaborate on that. It's like, if you go to the gym, well done, like you're halfway there, you really are.
Sure.
But I've just been so spoiled by having such personalized training and personalized exercise regimes created around what I do. And you go see what the general masses do, and you think, how the fuck is anyone getting in shape with having to wait for equipment, badly using equipment,
mm-hmm.
It seemed like going back 10 years. It was weird. It was like going back 10 years, and people don't look that happy. They're sweating and they're kind of doing things they think they should be doing. Yeah, it was a very weird experience. So it just made me appreciate, like, when you do put the right sort of effort in, not only are things more enjoyable, but you can get better results. There was one person I saw that was in really, really great shape, and they were using kettlebells, and the rest were,
Buggering around.
yeah, it was a real eye-opener. Hey,
I think,
do you still go to one of those
yeah,
gyms?
I do. I mean, I've got a national. I actually went to an event. They asked me to host at the Virgin Active in Menland, Maine, which is one of their smart. You know, they've got a couple of these collection gyms around the country,
Yeah.
which are really amazing. I mean, apart from that, all the equipment that you ever need is always there, and it's always clean, and it's always ready, and there's never any. You know, it's never a queue or a waiting period for you to use the stuff you want to use. And there are some real experts at those gyms too. And even the normal Virgin Actives, I don't mind going to if it's convenient and close. You see, the problem is that unless it's convenient, you're going to find an excuse not to go. And
Exactly.
I don't go, you know, if I'm in a meeting in Joburg and I've got an hour and a half, I'll go to somewhere in Joburg. I'm not going to go all the way to the one closest to my house. Anyway, they had this event for their founder clients, the people who joined when they opened that gym. And it was really nice. I mean, they gave them all a bottle of wine, and it was beautifully done. And they've got some great staff there. But those gyms are extraordinary because you walk in, they give you two towels, so you don't have to take your own dirty, sweaty towels around. And they have these
Nice.
beautifully washed, lovely, place is super clean and terrific. And there's nothing worse than a stinky old gym. And then, you know, they've got these facilities. I mean, I don't use there's a guy who'll polish your shoes. There's a place where you can have
Nice.
your shirt steamed, you know. So if you're going to work, if you have an important meeting at, let's say, 9 o'clock, and you want to get to the gym and train at 7:30, there's someone who will make sure that when you get out of the shower and you go and get dressed, your shirt is immaculate and your shoes are clean, and you can go and have a meal there, and then there's a boardroom that you can use, and there's Wi-Fi, and it's really impressive, you know. It's a well-kitted out gym. So it depends where you go and also how much you're willing to pay. But it should be almost like the idea of a club comes from those London clubs where people would live outside of London, and when they'd go into town for business, they would stay at their club. And their club was like an accommodation, but it was also a place where you could, you know, get a meal, where you could stay for a week. You had facilities that you needed, and that's really what I think they've tried to create. And some of these gyms are amazing, and I agree with you. Like, if you know what you're doing in a gym, it makes a huge difference. When I started training, you'll remember this, I was absolutely useless. I didn't know how to use anything, and then you really are just wasting your time. Like, you may as well not go, because you're probably doing more damage than
Yeah.
good.
Well, it's all about staying in the game, right? Staying the course. So whatever it is that gets you started, you must really find out that that's not enough. You must try to find ways to stay in it. But it's cool that people put effort in. And those kind of clubs, as you say, those London clubs, like it starts because people want to be connected and do better with their life. And you can be so much better when you have the training regime. But
And the
yeah,
facilities.
I mean, I've obviously just be I've almost like priced myself out of being a human, I think. So I'd struggle around having to wait around people
Oh no.
and being around like general congestion. People say, oh, you know, it's just you get older and quirky. Like
No. I'm cranky as fuck about that stuff. Same here.
I couldn't go back to I couldn't go back to that gym. It was kind of traumatic.
Yeah.
But also, I'm trying to grow a beard at the moment for the first time in my life, Gareth, and it is hard. It is really hard.
Snap. Same here.
Oh, you're trying
Yeah.
to grow a beard.
No, it's
Nice.
coincidental. I didn't know you were doing the same thing. It's taking me a little
No,
while, but yeah.
I haven't seen you in a couple of weeks.
No,
Yeah,
it's.
it's tough because I went and bought beard oil, and that was
Oh.
when I really realized I'm in the
Do
game.
you have to have
But
that stuff?
beard oil,
What do you need that for?
well, because it gets like quite irritable, right? Now, I haven't tried to grow a beard before. I know other people do it naturally. But when you got beard oil, there's obviously like soothing elements and it softens everything. But it's like putting vitamin E oil on yourself. It's very, 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 very oily.
Ugh.
So like whatever you try to do, it's like on you forever.
I don't
So I'm
like
pushing
that.
through with just basic moisturizer. But you know, like because I took a lot of interest in how hair grows because obviously I was losing hair. It's the same with a beard. Like if you just let it grow, it'll grow quicker. If you keep trimming it and pulling it back, it's not going to really have the,
So
desired effect.
are you just letting it grow, however? Because I don't want to look untidy. That's my biggest worry. And there's, you know, when you, I'm not growing it to keep it. I'm just going to grow it to see what happens. But I mean, this is maybe, you know, there are only a few bearded women who are going to be interested in this conversation. Otherwise, just a couple of guys, really. And I haven't met a bearded woman for a long time. I've got to say, they're becoming a very rare commodity. I would like to meet a
It's a
bearded woman.
shame.
And I know there used to be,
It's a shame. It was a good genre.
what great circus didn't have a bearded woman? You know, now they're like hen's teeth. You can't find them anywhere. But I've never really tried to grow a beard. It always irritated me, and it started looking untidy. So I'm going to see how it goes, but I'm not getting rid of it yet. I'll give it another week or two, see how it goes.
Yeah, well, you've also got very fair features, Gareth, so you're going to have
It's going to take a
blonde.
long
It'd be
time,
quite
yeah.
funny if you have a blonde beard.
I know, I might look very old. Or I might look
It'd be really
ridiculous.
funny.
Who knows?
It'd be really funny if your beard came through ginger and then you got to commit. You know what? I think we
Oh,
should do this.
Jesus.
Today is the what? 29th of July.
Oh, no, I
Let's
see a
commit.
challenge coming up. All right, yeah.
No, it's not a challenge. We're not doing this to save
29th,
money
all
for
right.
like
So,
orphaned whales or whatever.
29th of July. Let's go. What are we doing?
Let's give it 2 more weeks. How's that?
Ten.
That sounds okay, right? Two
10
more weeks.
weeks.
Two.
No,
Two.
Jesus, that
Two
takes us.
weeks.
Oh, two. That's fine. Yeah. All right. I'll do two
Settle
more
down.
weeks. All right. 2 more weeks.
Okay,
So
so August the 12th.
done.
August the 12th, we'll sit here either happy or we'll be cool. We're going to shave off the show.
Done. All right. We'll take a look at it then, because there's no point talking about it now. It's too soon. All right. We've got Jack Parrow joining us in a little while on cliffcentral.com. I'm pleased to be getting into that. Let's just talk about why people are quitting their jobs, Ben, because this is happening in America more than anywhere else. And it's partly because of the last 2.5 years and the pandemic. A lot of people didn't want to go back to the office and refused to go back to the office and quit their jobs thinking, I'll find something new or I'll find a job where they'll let me work from home. And a lot of companies are just they're not having any of it. So they're firing people too. But many Americans are quitting their jobs. And you have something to say about this.
Well, I find the whole thing about quitting a job so first world because, like, a lot of people don't have a choice.
Yeah.
A lot of people always talk about quitting their jobs, and I subscribe to this the stats thing, which I share with you from time to time, and some of the stuff is just very interesting. And I always think like there's like a rule in life that you must always have that sort of what's the universal phrase for it? That sort of like fuck off fund where you can literally go to your boss and say, "I'm done. I've had enough." Because then, if you have that, you'll always be able to have morals, and you'll be able to have like some sort of ethics. Because sometimes people quit their jobs because they're asked to do really bad things, or they have really, really terrible bosses.
Yeah.
So there's obviously lots of reasons around that, but a lot of people can't do it because they have to have the paycheck.
Yeah.
So I find it very interesting in the first world that they've actually put a stat together, they've put a study together of people who are like, "Eh, I'm just gonna, give this up, and I'll try again in a couple of months." That must be really, really cool to have that sort of freedom and confidence in yourself. Because I guarantee most people living in our country, our third world country, they are enduring jobs rather than enjoying them. And I'd love to know how high that stat is.
Well, even in the upper echelons of corporate South Africa, once people get to a certain level, their only interest is maintaining their salary because now they're earning a lot.
Yes.
So you get these people who are CEOs, COOs, CFOs, or whatever. They're at the top of the pyramid. They're earning way more than they would have earned anywhere else because now you're in the C-suite, you know? And these people are able to get all the company benefits. And all they have to do is just stay there. So they make no decisions that could get them into trouble. They pass the buck every time they can. They sit and wait and wait and wait till the last minute on making a move on anything. And they really aren't necessarily good for the company, but they're so desperate to hold on to their money and to hold on to that salary, that paycheck, for as long as they can. Because it could mean for them being able to send their kid to this university rather than that. It could mean for them they pay off their house. It could mean they buy a second house. It's a big thing. So don't only think of the people who have immediate monthly expenses that they wouldn't be able to deal with if they quit their job today. Think about those people at the top who are also so calcified in their positions because they're terrified of losing out on that money. So it happens at all layers. It's not just, you know, if you are the prisoner of, I don't know, 150 grand a month paycheck, or in some companies, it's way more than that even. It's very difficult to say no to that and to quit the job because now you want to go on an adventure or do something amazing. And this is part of our problem in society today, is that the money has become the reason people do things. And I'm not criticizing it, because a lot of my decisions have been made because of money. And hell, we all have expenses, right? We all have, you say, I need this much a month to live. And if you don't have that money every month, you're not going to live. You're going to have a very miserable existence. So it's not necessarily good or bad. We're not judging. But this idea of adventure, I think that's a great reason to quit a job. You know, you hear about these people who've traveled across Madagascar, or they've paddled around someplace in the Indian Ocean, or, you know, they went into the jungles of South America, or they just went on a really long walk through a part of the world where nobody else goes. And you think about places and people and things like that, and you think, wow, that must be really cool. That must be just to say bye-bye salary, bye-bye paying these expenses every month, bye-bye worrying about, oh, I've got to go to gym today and I've got a meeting at 10 o'clock and this is the stuff that you live for. I'm going to do a totally different thing. And I think there's, you know, some people will say there's a window period in your life where you can do that stuff, but I don't believe that. I think at any age, if the spirit of adventure calls you, you should be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously like a window period for certain things. Like, I'm at the age of 40, I'm probably not going to go to Miami on spring break. I think that window is closed.
Would you go to Ibiza, though? Would you go to Ibiza?
No, I'm not really keen on taking drugs, because you have to take lots of drugs at Ibiza. Yeah.
Would you go to would you go to the Greek islands for a sort of Greek island piss up holiday?
That sounds amazing. A lot of my friends are going to Greece in this winter window right now.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, what I find interesting, if we get away from the actual real world logistics of like the fact you can't quit your job, and most of us are a paycheck away from poverty, as being mentioned in the comments here, what would be the reason? So the study was like, people were like, you know, I'm not being valued. It's all these like snowflakey reasons why you want to quit your job. But what's like the positive thing? Because this is something I think we should all build into what we do. You know, people say, oh, we must save for retirement, we must save for this and save for that. But I think you've got to save for an adventure. So I think, like, without even going into it, you've hit the nail on the head there. You quit your job because you would like to actually live something, experience something. Not because you don't feel like you're being valued at the water cooler, or your ideas don't get the light of day. I mean, jobs are jobs, let's be honest. Everyone's going to be a dick at some stage in your career. You've got to live with it. But what's that thing that you would rather be doing? I want to go and spend, and I know this is like a very obvious kind of thing, where it was like cliche, but I would like to spend 2 months in the Kruger Park. I really would. And I want to do that within the next 2 years. I really do.
Well, we're talking to a guy next week, I think, who he's spending like 67 days in the Kruger Park or something. I mean, that 80, sounds
86, I think.
86. We're going to be speaking to him, and I mean, that sounds like an adventure. You know, a lot of people, though, I think a lot of people are running away from stuff too. So if you're going to do an adventure, great, then do that. But if you're running away from a boring life, or you're running away from people that you're trying to avoid, or, you know, responsibilities that you're trying to duck, that I don't have respect for.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like Gord's running away from those women he impregnated. Like, that's not a good idea. So, I mean, ideally, with every sort of talking point, you should probably have your stuff together, okay, sort of in life. But it'd be really cool to do that. And, you know, it's not about like going away and then suddenly learning, like suddenly you never take a poo in a toilet again, or suddenly you abandon your smartphone. You've still got to come back to your life, because we can't be cavemen.
Okay.
But like, what is that real adventure that you want to kind of do? And what, because as you say, like, certain of them have the window. And you can't fixate about this for 10 years and then not do it, or do it when you're old. You're not entirely sure if you can hold in a number one if you're on the road.
That's a good point. I mean, propaganda said here, this is a really good reason to quit. I quit a senior manager job to see my three-year-old grow up. Now she's 15. It was the best move ever. Well, great. Also, you'll never know. And I do think that's great propaganda. That's a good reason to do anything. But you only know that you made a good decision a long way afterwards. You know? What are you laughing at?
It's so funny. Rebellious Ruth in the comments said, propaganda is so great, you have your ducks in a row. I mean, geese.
People are clever. All right. Traveling Ninja Turtle says, the young millennials quit something as soon as it isn't fun. They're searching for adventure that they see on Instagram. None of them want to actually work to achieve something. You see, that's also true. It's like these people who are avoiding responsibility.
Yeah, definitely got to deserve it. You've got to build up a bit of hardship to really appreciate the stuff as well. Because if you go from adventure to adventure, it's like eating chocolate the whole time. At some stage, you've got to eat your veggies, so to speak, in life. And that's why you should actually have a job and learn systems and learn people. That's what makes you appreciate the time away.
Absolutely. All right, let me quickly tell you about something important. What makes Naked Insurance products different to the others is how they're powered by the latest tech to give you total control over your cover and to make insurance faster and easier than ever before. You can quote, buy, and switch insurance whenever it suits you, even at 2 a.m. in the morning if you feel like it. You can manage and customize every aspect of your cover on the Naked Insurance app. Just change your details, change your excess, you can update your cover, you can even pause it when you're not driving, which is a very cool feature. You can make claims, you can even cancel with just a click. Now, doesn't that sound easy? Well, the tech behind Naked also results in cost savings, which are passed on to the clients in the form of lower premiums. Also sounds good. So visit naked.insure or download the Naked Insurance app to sort out your insurance without a phone call. For many people, that's the worst, is having to deal with someone on the phone. So you can just get past all of that stuff. Just download the Naked app, and you can sort out your insurance in one fell swoop. Visit naked.insure. Naked Financial Technology is an authorized financial services provider. Go and check them out today. Naked.insure. Very, very nice. And if you're gonna quit your job and garden adventure, make sure that you've got that stuff organized, because you don't want to have all the trouble of going on some terrible road to a volcano that you're going to climb, and then your car gets eaten up by a volcanic magma flow. You don't need that happening. That would be a disaster. And you get back home with your tail between your legs, and everyone goes, "Oh, hi, Ben. How was your adventure?" "Well, my car was destroyed by a volcano, and now I have nothing to show for it. And I've lost all my money in the volcano as well." Not good.
Or elephants, Gareth. Probably more close to home. A stampede of elephants.
It happens, hey? The people who've had elephants, like, sit down on their cars. Got to make sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, so on Monday, you chatted to this guy, Chris. It's there's something amazing about the Kruger Park when you spend some time in there. Like, obviously, you go there to watch the animals, look at the animals. But one of the things I've always loved about that place is you look at the kind of people who are in there. Because obviously, there's the day trippers, right? But then there are those people who have the camper vans.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at them, and just judging by their face, obviously, if they've got horrible beards like ours, they might have been there for like a month.
Yeah. Right.
And there's always a guy, so there's couples basically always go through that.
And the foreigners.
And some of them are happy. Some of them, the foreigners and the couples that are in there. Some of them are happy. Some of them look a bit like, okay, I'm tired of being in a car with you for this long.
Well, I mean, you look at particularly old couples, and you can see they either have been around each other for a very, very long time and now had enough. Or you can see the old man farts in the car. The wife is sick of him.
Mm-hmm.
Or they've got lost. That happens a lot. "No, I'm telling you, it's left. No, it's right. No, it's left. No, it's right." And they scream at each other the whole time. So, yes, if you're watching people in the Kruger Park, it can be as entertaining as watching the animals. I find people's behavior is maybe not getting better in terms of the way that they behave. When, you know, if there's something that they see, then all the cars kind of block the road, and some people will drive past at great speed when someone's trying to, like, quietly watch something. There's no etiquette in there anymore. You're supposed to observe from a distance, kind of, you know, prioritize the animals, make sure that other people also have a chance to see these things. People don't really have the manners that they should in a place like that, because it's not yours. So you've found a leopard or something, then let other people see the goddamn leopard. Don't sit there for 6 hours watching it and blocking everybody else. I find that stuff annoying.
Yeah, but you have to get the best picture for social media. No one's gonna step back when that's at stake.
No, sorry, not for me. All right, so Ben, the other thing that you wanted to talk about was, and this is a big subject. Maybe we get into it after seven, because are men more romantic than women? I mean, my immediate answer is no, right? That's the obvious and easy answer, is no.
Well, my immediate answer is yes, because we have to be. So what I was having this conversation with a friend, and she was horrified the fact that I thought this. But if you think about it, it's like women have no game, right, when it comes to dating. Why? Because they don't need to. They're the ones that make the choice. They're hot. They're attractive. And guys are just looking to pick up. So women have no game, and women have no background into romance because they're not the ones pursuing. So I actually listened to a podcast around this that was very interesting, because, you know, nowadays, obviously, women have to be everything while also being nothing and also not existing, depending on which news publications you listen to.
Yeah.
But the whole thing about romance is that obviously it's a very general term, because, I mean, I wouldn't say like Saudi culture men are going to be raising the flag for romance, and most African cultures too, in a traditional Western definition of romance, obviously.
Yeah.
But I just thought there was such an interesting thing that people debate, because people, like you say, they'll always gravitate to like, oh, women are more romantic. No, women are more receptive of romance. But that doesn't mean that they own romance. Guys have to make the running. Guys, like when you watch a rom-com,
yeah,
who's the biggest star, the biggest action person in the rom-com? It's the guy. Because the guy has to do all the things. So it's, for me, this is such an open and shut case, but people were getting frothy with me about the fact that, oh, guys are so unromantic. It's like, well, then how did any guy get a girlfriend? By being romantic at some stage. Because they have to.
I know what you mean. It's just difficult to figure out, because men have to be that way in order to attract the women. But it's actually the women who respond best to that stuff. So you could argue that the women are the romantic ones, because for them, you know, again, this is anthropological. It boils down to the fact that women in their lifetimes will have 40 eggs, and they have to be very careful who they sleep with. So the standard for them choosing a man has to be much higher than the standard for a man who's just sleeping with a woman and produces millions and millions and millions of sperm every single day. That can fertilize and make a child. So for a man, the only standard is she's hot. Very often, that's all. That'll be enough, thank you, to get any guy to make a move to do something.
She's attractive. Can you be less of a caveman, please?
Well, she's attractive. Hot. For a girl, for a woman, it's really, really tough. There are a bunch of things that he's got to tick off. Because if she gets pregnant by him, there's a huge cost to her. First of all, there could be 9 months of bearing this child. There is a lifetime after that of having to look after it. Remember, all of this, you know, is baked in for generations and generations. And of course, people will say, "Oh, but now, you know, you've got contraception, you've got abortion, you've got all these different things that give women an opportunity to change that fate." And that's true. But we're talking about millions of years of evolutionary history and biology and memory that impact the way we behave. And you can't change that overnight. You can't change that in two generations. So women think like women have thought for thousands of years, and men think like men have thought for thousands of years. You're going to change that in a minute.
You've gone so deep off topic here.
You really think so?
Yeah. No, but like, you made a brilliant point.
Romance is just a part of the dating thing.
Yeah, okay, so you kind of lost me somewhere in the middle there. You made a great point at the beginning that women are more responsive to romance, so that makes them more romantic. But But that's like saying all fat people are the best chefs. Just because they love the food doesn't know how to know how to make it.
Ah, but the fat chefs are usually the best chefs.
Well, that's just combining two things,
Yeah, it's a
basically.
bit, it's a
But I just,
subset, you know, it's a subset of the big set.
yeah, I mean, look, there's another great message in the comments here about the fact that for men, romance is for survival because we
Yes.
have to find a mate.
Yes.
And yeah, to go to your deeper, much deeper point, I just think it's something that's it's really worth considering this weekend when you're having conversations with people. And also, just to remind guys that I think romance is something that should be completely in our DNA, rather than, well, fuck it, this is me, I'm good enough kind of thing.
Oh
Because
no, for
people on all
sure.
sides of the male
Yeah.
spectrum think that, and that's also wrong.
Oh no, listen, I saw some people. I went to a restaurant on Tuesday. No, Wednesday evening, and I was looking at some of these people, and I looked at how, you know, the women, they'll dress nicely, by and large. There are obviously some who break this rule, but they dress nicely, wearing makeup, they're looking quite glamorous, and then their fucking husbands are sitting there in a tracksuit. And you're like, what the hell is that? We got to talk about this a little bit more because it is fascinating, and it's the stuff that everybody has an opinion on. So I think we must get into it a little bit. That's coming up next, cliffcentral.com. It is Friday morning. It's just after 7 o'clock. We've taken a little bit longer than I thought we would. We've got lots to talk about still. Stick around.
Cliffcentral.com.